Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. I'm not a regular blogger, but when things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of Paul's first epistle to Timothy. How should one conduct himself in the house of God? Well, this is a kind of informal pastoral manual that Paul wrote to his protege Timothy, mentoring him in that very respect, telling him how to teach other pastors, because Timothy was kind of his overseer there, his bishop. The word bishop means overseer. And the churches in Ephesus were house churches, and those who led those churches we would call pastors or shepherds. And Timothy was the first among equals. It was a serious business. In that day, we pointed out, the economic structure of society was vastly different in Greco-Roman society than it is today in important respects. There was, for all intents and purposes, no middle class. People were either upper class and very well-to-do, some filthy rich, as many are today, and the rest were the large majority of people in the Greco-Roman Empire were slaves. They may have been highly educated, but nevertheless they were conquered people and they were slaves and owned by others. Most people were relatively poor. I'm not guessing. We know not only from history, but we also know that the composition, the constituency of the early church, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, was primarily made up of the little people, of poor people, not the high and mighty, not the well-born, the aristocrats, the patricians of society, and so forth. The influential people. There were some, of course, but not largely. And you didn't have all of the safety nets that we have in our democratic society today. You didn't have any welfare system. You didn't have nursing homes, all that kind of thing. So when one died, a husband, a wife, or something like that, here you had a wife who was a widow indeed. A widow indeed was, among other things, one who was totally destitute. Paul makes it very clear in chapter 5, starting with verse 3, that among the widows, if they have families, it's the duty of families. All families, but he's speaking of Christian families. It's the duty of Christian families to take care of their own, especially if their own are believing. Parents, believing grandparents, or whatever. It's the duty of children to step up. And he goes on to point out, if people don't step up, well, here's a most searing, scorching indictment of them. If one does not provide for his own, it's not just then, but also now, and especially those of his own household, that's his immediate family, well, the implications of that, he's denied the faith, spell that apostate, and he's worse than an unbeliever. Can't get any worse than that. Then he goes on to talk about a roster of widows, as existed in the early church, for very sensitive ministries, and these were put on a list, and they had to meet certain qualifications. These monies of the church were not doled out to widows just as welfare clients. They were given the dignity of ministries. Not all of these would necessarily have been widows indeed. There are a lot of complications here in understanding some of this. I discussed that the last time, but this was an important ministry in the church and the social and economic structure of the time. But whoever went on that list was not to be, we saw, less than 60 years of age for very good reasons. They were to be people who were really invested in a life of piety and the work of God. I'm not going to go back over all of that. People who had a reputation for good works, people who had brought up children. There's no slur there on those who are unable to have children. But if these people were going to help those with children to be counselors and advisors, then mothers are the best to do that, or at least those who have been mothers and know the rules of the game, so to speak. We come to verse 11, where we were as the last program wound down. But there's one group of widows that you want to be sure not to enroll, because those on this register had taken a sacred vow. They had become widows. They had decided, okay, I've been married. I had my husband. I enjoyed my married life, or maybe they didn't. But now I want to devote the rest of my life strictly to Christ. I want the rest of my life to be without distraction in my service to Him. That's according to Paul, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Sounds like a good idea to me, they would say. And then they would take this sacred vow to dedicate themselves to Christ. All that is good. But Paul says, in a touch of realism, says, don't let younger widows, those younger than 60, do that. Refuse to put younger widows on the list. For when they feel sensual desires, and that's understandable with younger widows, they meet somebody, they see somebody, and they feel drawn to them. And in the process, they begin to come restive under the chains of those vows, those sacred vows they've taken, and turn their back on Christ. And they want to get married. And this brings upon them condemnation. This brings upon them divine censure. Because they've set aside their previous pledge, they have treated their vow to God as a light thing, and that shows disrespect to God. That's really taking His name in vain in the most serious way. It's like setting aside a marriage vow. And we don't want to put them in a position to fail, and that's what we're likely to do, Paul says, so be wise here. If you do that, at the same time, he says, they learn to be idle. As they go around from house to house, the problems are just beginning, not merely idle, but also they become gossips and busybodies, and they go around talking about things not proper. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married. I want them to bear children, to keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. For verse 15, some have already turned aside. I've seen it before, he says. It's terrible. Some have already turned aside. Their guilty conscience has gotten all over them like white on rice, and like Adam and Eve, it's driven them from God and right into the arms of Satan. They've turned aside to follow Satan. So if any woman who is a believer has dependent widows, let her assist them, and let not the church be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed. Comes back full circle to where he started. Referring to this verse 13, at the same time, these younger widows learn to be idle, so they shouldn't be put on the list and put under a vow. We're just setting them up for failure. As they go around from house to house, not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies talking about things not proper to mention. I know a retired firefighting officer who always said that the fire stations where there were the most problems were invariably the ones where the firefighters were least busy with fires and other emergencies. That's just human nature. Too much idleness is good neither for children nor adults. We all know the problems with standing water. In fact, I have noticed over the years of my ministry that the attitudes of many older folk begins to biodegrade in proportion to their relative inactivity. That's unfortunate. Busy, industrious folk are less likely than idle persons to gripe and complain, murmur and grumble, meddle and gossip. So Paul, the apostle, was, under the influence of the Holy Spirit here, a realist about human nature. The best defense against these base tendencies that he cites is a good offense. So he recommends that younger widows of marrying age and childbearing age don't enroll in this widow's register under some sacred vow where we set them up for failure. If they're under 60, don't enroll them, but rather let those get married, let them bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. They'll give the enemy an occasion for reproach, get them involved in all these vices and stirring up carnal juices, toxifying the body, and giving the enemy occasion to accuse and smear the people of God for their excesses. So we've got to be wise here, and Paul gives Timothy some really prudent advice. The vices he foresees, he has seen before. You can believe that's what he means. And the serious consequences he describes in verse 15. For some, such younger widows, he means those under 60, have already turned aside to follow Satan. Some commentators, unjustifiably in my opinion, mute the full force of this comment. They make it simply to say they've erred in listening to Satan and doing his bidding. I don't think that's all Paul means. The language is too strong to construe Paul to mean that some young widows have just given way to carnal impulses temporarily. He's already indicated that their spiritual ear, as it were, has crossed the center line. Now he seems to say, in the case of some, they've crashed the barriers, they've turned away from following Christ, and are now following Satan as his disciples. And the word for that is apostasy, falling away from God. There is the terror of messing around with a guilty conscience. That's why in this epistle it's been mentioned again and again to keep a good conscience. Folks, your conscience is the watchdog of the soul. It barks when we are transgressing God's lines. Now, sometimes our consciences may not be perfectly calibrated with the Word of God, but we should always respect our consciences and not transgress them, because the minute we do that, that breeds guilt. You know what happened to Adam and Eve when they felt guilty in the garden? They were guilty. They ran from God. And when we start running from God like rabbits, then we're out in the open, and Satan begins to chase us down. Under the weight of guilt, we start feeling lonely, and we start feeling despondent, and then we want a palliative. We want an aspirin, or we want some sort of heavy drug of pleasure, something to give us an upper, to make us feel good again. And we turn this way and that, and sometimes people will turn to false doctrine, some doctrine that allows them to make their peace with God, but it is no peace with God, and get into all sorts of traps that will destroy them. Don't mess around with a guilty conscience. Confess your sins and deal with those. Well, what happens is the horse is broken out of the barn and it's run off into the wilderness. If there's one thing the New Testament teaches us about born-again men and women, it is this: they are changed. They've been delivered from the kingdom of darkness into the glorious liberty of God's Son. If we know Christ, we're emancipated. We cannot be described as followers of Satan. It is one thing to say that we surrender to the flesh from time to time. We all do. It's one thing to say that our actions are carnal. We all go there. It's one thing to say we give the enemy occasion to reproach. We all have. But it is an entirely different order of statement to say, as Paul does, that one has turned aside to follow Satan. In other words, to go in a diametrically opposite direction than following Christ. Such a statement is tantamount of accusing professing people of God of rank apostasy. You can go to 1 John chapter 3, for example, read it, and in fact the entire epistle. One cannot imagine John, the apostle, speaking of anyone that John is willing to call a believer as someone who's turned aside to follow Satan. Just read 1 John chapter 3. I think you'll agree. And I don't think Paul did either. Well, now, in verse 16, Paul addresses, I take it, believing women of means who may have widows in their family circle. In that case, he says, they should be their provider in order that the church should not be burdened. These churches were not rich churches. They may have been generous and liberal in their stewardship, but they were constituted mainly of poor people. So let not the church be burdened, caring for those to whom others are responsible. Church may be unable, with its limited resources, to assist any but widows indeed. In the caring equation, a lesson to be learned here is this. I've hammered on it before, I hammer on it again. The lesson is that of concentric circles of social responsibility and Christian charity. I'm repeating myself. It's not that we Christians are to care only or primarily for those nearest us, but it is that our duty, our Christian duty, it is this, to care and to provide begins at home, though it does not end there. If we, as God's people, cannot care for those nearest and dearest, it just shows that the so-called love that we extend to those remote from us is obviously driven by some motive other than Christian compassion for the needy and distressed. What motive might that be? Well, just to feel good about ourselves, not to honor God, to get a little applause, to get a little write-up in the paper, maybe a picture of us doing these things and pat ourselves on the back. There's a lot of that that goes on in the Christian world. As Paul has already indicated, something is terribly amiss, spiritually, in those who refuse to care for their own. Start there. Besides, it's impractical to dilute the resources of the church in assisting those for whom others should step up. If they won't, then the church will have to do it, and that's not the way it should be. Now, beginning in verse 17, the apostle doubles back on his instructions to Timothy to add more directions concerning elders. Remember, this book is kind of an informal pastoral manual. He told Timothy in chapter 3, verse 15, I'm writing you to instruct you how you ought to order things, how you ought to conduct yourself in the house of God. Let the elders, he says, who rule well, be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. Let's look at that phrase, the elders who rule well. I mention once again, for those who did not hear our study in chapter 3, do not confuse the elders mentioned here with a board of lay elders or deacons in your church. That is most commonly done, but that's a mistake. So to repeat, before we go on, in New Testament nomenclature or terminology, three terms are used in different contexts to refer to the very same office. Those three terms are these: elders, bishops, and shepherds. Shepherds are pastors. One is a Greek word, one is a Latin word. I mean, shepherds is based upon the Greek word, poimen, and then the Latin word, pastor. These were individuals who led the house churches in the various cities. The church at Ephesus, I say again, like the church at Corinth, like the church at Jerusalem or Rome, was not one big congregation that met in a coliseum or some giant facility. There were no such facilities. But they met in various home venues throughout the city, and that you perhaps noticed when you've read the epistles that say, greet the church that meets in the home of so-and-so. Let the elders who rule well. Ruling is the office work of all church elders, meaning pastors or shepherds. The Greek word, poiestemi, not that you care, but that is the word. It means to stand at the head of, to direct or rule. That word, poiestemi, is tinged with authority. Someone said that the early church was comfortable with the idea of authority, but the modern age, including the church, is not comfortable with any authority. Now, that statement may be a bit extreme on both ends, but as I have emphasized before, evangelical churches have imbibed way too deeply of the wine of modern individualism and the hatred of all authority. Now, the imposition of authority is by no means a panacea for all the ills that affect the church. But we have gone hog wild on our American individualism and democracy in so many of our churches. But as most wise people recognize, I think, the worst remedy to wicked and overbearing authority, especially in a church, is the rule of the carnal mob. That is what you get when people try to import democracy into church polity And that's what we have done in generous supply here in America. I grew up in a Baptistic tradition. I'm not ashamed of it in most ways, but I hate that. I've always hated it. I've seen mostly trouble come from it. Battling Baptist, what a scandal. Without the recognition of spiritual authority, everything gets out of control. Now, it can get out of control with authority, we must concede. And we certainly see that. As with any job, some elders would prove to be more conscientious and able than others in governing their flocks, and govern they did. Paul says these are worthy of double honor in any age. What does double honor mean? Greater respect or greater remuneration or honor plus remuneration. Which one? That honor may mean financial support is clear from chapter 5, verse 3, where honoring those who are widows destitute of other means of support obviously entails financial undergirding as a material sign of honor. So, here in chapter 5, verse 17, and verse 18 will seal the case. The idea is that within the class of men who govern local bodies, who are their shepherds, those who apply themselves diligently to preaching and teaching, those should be more amply supported than those not as intensively engaged in this work. Hence, our word honorarium as a material symbol of honor. Now, this bifurcation, what do I mean, this separation that's referred to here. Let those be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching, implying that some were not so involved. This bifurcation suggests that in the primitive organization of the local churches, there may have been those shepherds who were more focused on running and maintaining the churches than on teaching the church and devoting themselves rigorously to that ministry. In fact, we still see that today oftentimes, where a pastor is a better administrator of church life than a teacher or mentor in Christian faith and practice. The former, pastor who's a good administrator of church life, is not without value. But the latter requires the most investment of time and does the church the most good in the long run. I've always said, as a pastor, church of any size, and mine is no megachurch, but a church of any size, a pastor is the functional equivalent of a CEO as well as a shepherd. If I'm going to neglect one or the other, it's going to be the CEO aspect. I'm going to be a shepherd first, God willing. Paul says of those who excel at preaching and teaching, take good care of them, double care. For these are not weekend warriors, as the saying goes, by necessity. They have withdrawn themselves from the marketplace for the sake of your souls. So you as a church, you allow them the freedom to do that. Honor them amply. That seems to me to be the spirit of his direction, and we should remember that. Some churches, especially in smaller towns and venues, are very suspect on this score, very negligent, very lackadaisical. There's that old saying, Lord, you keep them humble and we'll keep them poor. Some places it's a scandal. Some places the pastors have no choice but to moonlight. It's absolutely absurd. If your church out there, you make sure that you're doing everything you can if you've got a faithful pastor to honor him. Make sure that he has enough to feed his family. Make sure he has enough to take care of his kids. Make sure he has enough to get adequate insurance. Don't put him in that position where he has to do tent making in order to minister to you. That's the abnormal thing. That should not be the case. Well, we'll continue there next time. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.